had bombed a Cuban airplane, killing 73 people, and was now living freely in the United States. He is Cuba's bin Laden. Iran-Contra and Central American death squads. How Cuban exiles in the United States planned bombings in Cuba, and on and on. I sat calmly listening to this recitation for well over an hour, gazing neutrally at Alejandro while he spoke in a Spanish that I barely understood, waiting for translation. I knew I could respond with a similar list of Cuban transgressions. Ricardo, who sat next to me silently, had warned that something like this was coming. I looked down at my talking points, which did not cover this expanse of history. I realized that my relative youth could be an advantage. "I understand that this history is important to you," I said when he was finished. "But I wasn't even born when a lot of this happened." I folded my hands in front of me and looked at Alejandro while the words were translated. "President Obama wasn't even born when the Bay of Pigs invasion took place. He sent me here to look forward, and that's what I want to do." I talked about how we'd recently opened relations with Burma, how we'd worked to move beyond history in the Americas. "You mentioned Iran-Contra," I said. "President Obama just recently shared a dinner table with Danny Ortega, the Sandinista leader whom the U.S.-backed Contras had fought against. So we can overcome the past, all of us, even if it's important to us." During the lunch break, we broke from our roles. I went downstairs for a few minutes to gather my thoughts, and when I came back up, standing over a tray of sandwich wraps and sodas, Ricardo was talking about fishing in the waters off Cuba and the Florida Keys. "It's sad," I said, "that Cuba is only 90 miles from Florida, yet so few Americans have been able to travel there." "Jay-Z and Beyoncé just visited," Alejandro said. "People-to-people exchange," I joked. Alejandro laughed loudly, holding a sandwich in one hand. Then he turned serious. "The Cuban people," he said, "were very respectful of them. They admired how they carried themselves with dignity and humility." "At least they were able to go," I said. "But it didn't make our lives easier in the White House." "I am surprised," he said, "at how you treat us here with respect. We can tell that you are treating us as equals." We stood chewing our food, pondering this observation. The rest of the day we circled around our agenda. There was the occasional tense moment when they attacked our democracy programs and when we defended the right of people in Cuba to protest. But just the fact that we sat there for 6 hours talking, back and forth, without descending into argument, felt like an achievement. We'd accomplished our minimal objectives for the meeting, establishing a channel, building a relationship, agreeing that we would meet again in a few weeks. At the airport, Ricardo and I settled in at the bar, which looked like just about every airport bar I've ever been to in my life, just two guys grabbing a couple of beers before catching a flight back to Dulles. Ricardo made careful notes about next steps, yet we both knew that the real achievement was the meeting itself. The right Cubans had shown up, and they seemed determined to build a relationship that could lead somewhere. Ricardo closed his notebook and settled into his beer. He was the kind of guy who seemed to indulge in any small privilege that life offered up. The song that comes on the radio. The view of a lake from the house where we'd met the Cubans. The memory of some fishing spot off the coast of Cuba. He'd spent nearly 15 years working on Cuba, which meant he'd spent nearly 15 years being frustrated. "I think these guys are serious," he said, as we stared at a television on mute. "This could be the real deal." Southeast Asia became the other region I took on, as it pulled together the different threads of what interested me the most in our foreign policy. The burden of history, and the wars in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. The strategic importance of a region that was increasingly important to our position vis-à-vis China. An essential part of any effort to combat climate change. A sprawling place populated by people of different religions and ethnicities. A place of opportunity. Burma was at the beginning of what was going to be a long and uncertain transition. Aung San Suu Kyi was now a member of parliament, leading her National League for Democracy, NLD, the largest opposition party to the military. Political prisoners who had spent decades in jail were being released. Generals were trying to reinvent themselves as politicians. Western corporations were debating whether to invest. Ethnic insurgencies continued to rage in the periphery. In Rakhine State, along Burma's border with Bangladesh, a Rohingya Muslim minority was persecuted by the Burmese military and a Buddhist majority. In July, I set off to Burma for the first time without Obama. Our envoy there was Derek Mitchell, an expert on Asia and democracy who had helped design our Burma policy. He was, as far as I could tell, one of the busiest men in the country. "The Burmese are drowning in work," he told me as we drove into Naypyidaw, Burma's planned capital city, on an empty 10-lane highway. He explained that a main driver of reform was the success of other Southeast Asian countries. Burma's generals had gotten tired of traveling to places like Singapore and feeling left behind. Another was China. The corruption that came with living under Chinese influence was sparking a backlash among the people. Finally, there was Suu Kyi, an icon popular enough to hold together a potent opposition, but struggling to adapt to life as a politician. "She's focused almost entirely on reforming the Constitution," he said. "So she can become president?" I asked. "Yes, but she'd say also to end military rule." The military still operated without any civilian control and had a prescribed block of seats in the parliament. "But if they're opening up, doesn't that ultimately lead to her being president?" I asked. "Probably," he said. "Everyone knows that there's only one end to the story, but no one knows how to get there." Over the course of the day, in giant government buildings, I would sit at the far end of rooms as large as football fields opposite a Burmese official. It seemed as if there were three types of public figures in Burma: dissidents turned politicians who had no experience governing, military men who had turned into reformers but didn't know how to operate in a democracy, and hardliners resisting change. The one meeting that was different was with the president's chief of staff, an older man named U So Thein. Instead of a ceremonial room, we met in his small working office. His desk was piled with papers, and he greeted us as if taking a break from nonstop work. He spoke English, and every time I raised an issue, he squinted and nodded, a slightly pained look on his face, as if to say, "I know, but we can go only so fast." "We have the Citizenship Action Plan," he said about the Rohingya. "Already we are granting citizenship cards for those who apply." "But only if they don't identify themselves as Rohingya," Derek interjected. The Burmese denied that the Rohingya were a distinct ethnic group, referring to them as Bengalis, illegal immigrants from neighboring Bangladesh. For the next 3.5 years, we'd have to constantly press the government, often working with other countries, to prevent the situation from spiraling out of control. "The situation is very complicated," So Thein said. "We aren't going to change the views of the local Rakhine or the people in Burma, but we are moving forward." He lamented that he was so busy, saying that he'd prefer the life of a writer. He kept ticking off to-do lists, giving the appearance of doing everything at once. Aung San Suu Kyi greeted me at the entrance of the parliament building and guided me to a corner of a room where we sat on couches. She seemed different outside her Yangon home, where she had the air of an icon sitting under her framed portrait of Gandhi. There, she was the hero who'd spent a huge chunk of her life sacrificing in principled opposition to autocracy, missing the death of her husband and the lives of her children who remained in England. Here, she was a politician, taking a break from parliamentary maneuvers. The only nod to her icon status was the characteristic flower in her hair. I handed her a letter from Obama and said that he wanted me to check in with her. "Well, what is it you want to say?" she asked. She seemed curt, distracted. I expressed our support for Burma's transition to democracy, falling into the points that had been prepared for me. I encouraged her to support efforts to promote reconciliation with Burma's ethnic groups and better conditions for the Rohingya. "We will get to those things," she said. But first must come constitutional reform. The military could change the Constitution in a moment. Everything she said indicated that she cared mostly about the upcoming 2015 election, in which she was barred from seeking the presidency by a provision that disqualified people with foreign-born children, known informally as the Aung San Suu Kyi provision. It won't be a free and fair election without constitutional reform. Every time I returned to different issues, she kept turning the conversation back to the election and the Constitution. "Of course we care about human rights," she said, "for all our people. But we cannot have human rights without democracy." She'd spent decades imprisoned, and could now envision actually becoming president of the nation her father had founded before he was assassinated. "I'm so close," her body language seemed to suggest. That night, on the balcony of my hotel room in Yangon, I watched as feral dogs circled each other down below, darting through short bursts of traffic. Parking attendants, newly employed at this luxury hotel, shouted instructions at cars as they maneuvered through an undersized lot. I thought about the distance from the street scene to the cartoonish capital where decisions were made, and the even greater distances to places like Washington and Beijing that set the course for the wider world. The next day, Derek arranged for me to see a sampling of the many different facets of Yangon society adapting to change. Former political prisoners ate sparingly at a luncheon and spoke with single-minded focus about their efforts to free the remaining prisoners. One writer told me, in a matter-of-fact way, that she had nearly died in prison because she shrank to under 80 pounds. Rohingya brought me large volumes of documentation, proving that they had lived in Burma for generations, as if I were the one who would judge this fact. Rakhine Buddhists were unabashed in their bigotry, speaking of the Bengalis as illegal immigrants who needed to be deported. At the Myanmar Peace Center, we talked to a small group of men trying to negotiate a ceasefire with more than a dozen ethnic armed groups. I was surprised to see pamphlets that translated the Cairo speech into Burmese. I asked why the speech was of interest to people here. "The people admire Obama," one man said. "We use this speech to teach them how to be tolerant of people from different religions." At a round table with me, representatives from America's business community were full of complaints about doing business in a country with no experience of it. I agreed to a contract at a ministry only to find that the terms had changed by the time I got home, one said. Derek told me about the government cronies who still control huge chunks of the economy. One of them offered a several thousand dollar bottle of wine at a dinner in his house, which is near a street where people beg for food. The people who were sanctioned by the United States seemed to be doing just fine. It was the rest of the country that was suffering. Derek was determined to give me a feel for the city, and my last night there we walked out on darkened streets with few lights. We were joined by three young women, one Burmese, one American, one French, who led an NGO dedicated to preserving the old city. We walked into dilapidated buildings, smelling of urine with trash filling the hallways, wires hanging from the ceilings, squatters in the empty apartments. The women took out flashlights and pointed them down to the floors where, under layers of dust, you could see Art Deco tiles from the 1920s. The tour ended at an old movie theater. We entered by walking across wooden doors that covered open sewage drains, then climbed a flight of musty stairs. A kitschy soap opera-style Burmese film was playing on an enormous curved screen. A handful of people were sitting in the darkness. The women lit their flashlights to reveal an impossible glamour. Balcony seats like an aged opera house, empty of human beings. It was like standing in some forgotten past. Then we headed outside, back across the wooden doorway, into an uncertain future. Burma, in the minds of Americans like me, was a place where Aung San Suu Kyi suffered imprisonment to promote democracy, a recognizable concept, a commendable struggle. Years of U.S. sanctions had been put in place to support her struggle. But the actual country was a mystery that eluded easy understanding, with a cosmopolitan capital ready for change, a sprawling countryside where people's lives unfolded out of sight, and a violent periphery where the government held little writ. The only thing that united all of these elements was Su Qi herself, an icon of democracy, the daughter of the national hero, a politician who did not control the levers of power. Chapter 18. Red Line. On Wednesday, August 21st, 2013, Anne and I were sitting on a flight waiting to take off when I saw a news story on my BlackBerry reporting a potentially catastrophic chemical weapons attack in Syria. The plane took off and I had several hours without internet. We were going to spend a few days with Anne's family in Portland, Oregon, before heading down to Orange County to her mother's house. It was her sister's 50th birthday and the anniversary of her father's death. It was my first vacation in more than a year. On the plane, I thought about the news. Chemical weapons had been a concern in Syria for the last year. In July 2012, we received reports that the regime was preparing to use them against the opposition or transfer them to the terrorist organization Hezbollah. Assad had huge stockpiles of sarin gas. There were concerns in Israel that any sarin passed to Hezbollah could be used against Israelis. As soon as we received those initial reports in July 2012, McDonough convened a task force that developed a plan to issue private warnings to Russia, Iran, and the Syrian government. We prepared some carefully worded language that Obama used in a speech to the veterans of foreign wars on July 23, 2012. Given the regime's stockpiles of chemical weapons, we will continue to make it clear to Assad and those around him that the world is watching and that they will be held accountable by the international community and the United States should they make the tragic mistake of using those weapons. At first, it seemed that the warnings worked. Weeks and months went by with no sign of chemical attacks. In August 2012, Obama was asked about what could lead him to use military force in Syria. "We have been very clear to the Assad regime," he said, "that a red line for us is we start seeing a whole bunch of chemical weapons moving around or being utilized. That would change my calculus." In the course of a presidency, a U.S. president says millions of words in public. You never know which of those words end up cementing a certain impression. For Obama, one of those phrases would be red line. Late in 2012, we received reports of small-scale chemical weapons use. These reports were difficult to verify in a place as chaotic as Syria, where many horrifying weapons were being used against civilians, from tear gas to napalm to barrel bombs. The U.S. intelligence community was resistant to snap judgments, particularly after the experience of the inaccurate statements made about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq before the 2003 U.S. invasion. So it took a period of months before the intelligence community formally determined that the Assad regime had in fact used chemical weapons. When this assessment was released in April 2013, the question became what we were going to do about it. To show Assad and the world that there would be consequences, Obama decided to publicize a decision to provide military support to the Syrian opposition, the latest iteration of the plan that Petraeus had first presented in 2012. It was an unsatisfying response, and there weren't any volunteers to announce the plan publicly. Almost by default, the responsibility fell to me. Even though I had misgivings about our Syria policy, I was glad that we were doing something. I had also internalized a certain ethos. If there was an issue that no one wanted to talk about publicly, I would do it. I thought it was a form of leadership, given my responsibility for communications across the government. I thought it was part of my job, as Obama deserved to have someone willing to defend him. I sensed, though, that it would cost me, allowing me to be blamed for decisions I didn't make but that others didn't want to defend. And defend it I did. On conference calls, in televised briefings, and in long conversations with reporters. I fought with lawyers to get clearance to say that Obama had decided to provide direct military support to the Syrian opposition, as we were in the impossible position of not being able to discuss details about a key element of our policy. Legally, we couldn't say what the support was. All I could say were things like, "This is going to be different in both scope and scale in terms of what we are providing to the opposition." I was giving partial answers about an incremental response and felt as though whatever stockpile of credibility I had built up over 4 years was being drawn down. That summer had been thankless in so many other ways. It began with the spectacle of Edward Snowden releasing a devastating cache of classified information in June, fleeing to Hong Kong, and then somehow boarding a plane to Moscow, even though he had no passport. There were weeks of drip, drip, drip revelations about U.S. surveillance, the same tactic that would shadow the run-up to our 2016 elections, involving the same people. Russia, WikiLeaks. I had to spend my days explaining to our liberal base that Obama wasn't running a surveillance state because of the activities of the NSA, which we couldn't really talk about. Then came the Egypt coup, which we refused to call a coup. Instead of carrying out an affirmative agenda, I felt I spent my days in a defensive crouch. As our August vacation began, I was wrestling with my own creeping suspicion that Obama was right. Maybe we couldn't do much to direct events inside the Middle East. Maybe U.S. military intervention in Syria would only make things worse. I wanted to get away from Washington, to stare at the ocean, to get reacquainted with my wife, to read a book. When our plane finally touched down in Portland, I had more than 100 emails, some with harrowing accounts of how scores of people had been killed by clouds of gas on the outskirts of Damascus. I had a sense of foreboding as Anne and I checked into our hotel. As we fell into the rhythm of a family vacation, I sensed Anne keeping a careful eye on how much I was looking at my BlackBerry, silently anticipating the inevitable encroachment of world events. At the same time, I could sense the frantic response building back in Washington through my inbox, invitations to meetings I wouldn't be attending, draft talking points I had to approve, news stories pressing Obama to respond, photos of lifeless children who had choked to death. I was asked to find a way to attend a meeting that Obama was going to convene with his National Security Council. I drove to an FBI field office out by the airport and parked in an empty lot. A couple of guys who looked annoyed to be working on a weekend set up a secure video link for me so I could be patched into the Situation Room. I listened as it was reported that there was a high-confidence assessment that a sarin gas attack had killed more than 1,000 people in a suburb of Damascus, and that the Assad regime was responsible. One after another, officials advised Obama to order a military strike. This included the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Marty Dempsey, who had internalized the limits of U.S. military action in the Middle East. One time he surprised me in the hallway of the West Wing by recommending that I read Rachel Maddow's book, Drift, The Unmooring of American Military Power. Up to this point, he had argued that Syria was a slippery slope where there was little chance of success. Now he said that something needed to be done even if we didn't know what would happen after we took action. When the conversation got around to Obama, he asked about the UN investigators who were going to the scene of the attack to obtain samples. Could something be done to get them out? I thought the tone of the whole meeting suggested an imminent strike. The advisor who urged the most caution against military action was Dennis McDonough, who raised questions about the legal basis for it and what would come next. What if we bombed Syria and Assad responded by using more of his chemical weapons? Would we put in ground troops to secure those stockpiles? At the end of the meeting, Obama said he hadn't yet made a decision but wanted military options prepared. I walked outside and convened a conference call with the lead communicators for the government on national security. Pacing back and forth in an empty parking lot, I started to plan a public campaign to ramp up to a military intervention. John Kerry could make a statement that Monday making the case for action. The intelligence community would have to make its assessment public. DOD needed to prepare for an announcement of strikes. It felt energizing, as though we were finally going to do something to shape events in Syria. I rejoined Anne and her family at a restaurant. I told her there was a chance I'd have to go back early. "Why can't someone else do this?" she asked. McDonough called me and said that I needed to get back as soon as I could. I knew that that would upset Anne. We had plans to visit her father's grave on the anniversary of his death. I asked McDonough if it was possible for Obama to call so he could talk to Anne, something he occasionally did for people who have grown weary of their spouse's work schedule. Instead, I got a short email from Obama telling me to come home as soon as possible. Sitting in a crowded restaurant among my in-laws, I felt the loneliness of knowing that I'd have to do what the President of the United States was asking me to do, and that on the scale of what was going wrong in the world, my own inconvenience, however dramatic in the context of my family, was not going to be anyone else's concern. I waited a couple of hours before telling Anne, trying to preserve for a little while longer the illusion of normalcy. I flew back to Washington the next morning. As we sat outside the Oval Office waiting for the morning briefing with Obama, the Director of National Intelligence, Jim Clapper, looked agitated. A Vietnam veteran, former Air Force Lieutenant General, and longtime intelligence professional, Clapper was an avuncular older guy with a bald head. He spoke in clipped sentences and had an easy rapport with Obama, who liked to needle him for always dropping paper clips on the rug in the Oval Office. Clapper never put spin on the ball. He told you what he knew and what he didn't know. I respected him as much as anyone in government. Speaking to me and Susan, who had recently become National Security Advisor, Clapper said that it wasn't yet a slam-dunk case that Assad had authorized the chemical weapons attack. The assessment would firm up over time as samples were gathered and information analyzed. The choice of words was striking. "Slam dunk" was the exact phrase that George Tenet, then director of the CIA, had used to assure George W. Bush that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Clapper seemed to be signaling that he wasn't going to put the intelligence community in the position of building another case for another war in the Middle East that could go wrong. When we entered the Oval Office, we took our usual seats, Obama in his armchair opposite Biden, Clapper at the end of one couch opposite Rice, Lisa Monaco, Obama's counterterrorism advisor, and Tony Blinken, Rice's deputy, in the other seats on the couches, and Jake Sullivan, now Biden's national security advisor, in a chair next to me, filling out a semicircle. I always took this seat because I liked to face Obama, which made it easy to make eye contact. Obama could signal a lot with his eyes. Clapper always opened with a summary of key intelligence. On this morning, he indicated that all signs pointed to Assad's ordering a catastrophic sarin attack, but then he paused and repeated his line that the case was not yet a slam dunk, using air quotes for emphasis. His words hung in the air. Obama made eye contact with me, and I could tell we were both thinking the same thing. This will find its way into the press. "Jim," Obama said, "no one asked you if it was a slam dunk." I felt the burden on Obama. He had to respond to this awful event in Syria while bearing the additional weight of the war in Iraq, which caused his own intelligence community to be cautious, his military to be wary of a slippery slope, his closest allies to distrust U.S.-led military adventures in the Middle East, the press to be more skeptical of presidential statements, the public to oppose U.S. wars overseas, and Congress to see matters of war and peace as political issues to be exploited. Later that day, in a Principals Committee meeting, Clapper repeated the slam-dunk formulation. Sure enough, later that week it leaked. In that same Principals Committee meeting, Clapper said that the intelligence community would not prepare an assessment for public release. Instead, he suggested they share all of their information and judgments with me, and I could write a U.S. government assessment, which they would review for accuracy and sign off. It took me a moment to understand what he was suggesting. In all my time at the White House, I had never written that kind of assessment and never would again. These were usually technical documents produced by teams of people in the intelligence agencies. After the meeting, I called Jake Sullivan and Bernadette Meehan into my office. Meehan was a 37-year-old Foreign Service officer who worked for me. Twice she had nearly been killed during overseas tours. In Colombia, a group of men had kidnapped her and thrown her into the trunk of a car. After driving for some time, they stopped and tossed her out on the side of the highway. A few years later, posted in Baghdad, she was badly wounded by a rocket fired by an Iran-backed militia. Still, she kept at it. She spoke Arabic and loved the Middle East. "He really asked you to write it?" she asked me. "That's what he said. Ask Jake." She looked over and he nodded, having been in the meeting. "Are you going to do it?" she asked. "What choice do I have?" I understood that Clapper was protecting the intelligence community from a repeat of the role it played before the war in Iraq. But this was different. Our intelligence community had a high-confidence assessment that a weapon of mass destruction had been used by the Assad regime. The evidence was running in a loop on our television screens. We worked out a plan whereby each of us would write a different piece of what would be a U.S. government assessment instead of an intelligence assessment. We were given stacks of intelligence reports about what had happened, as well as volumes of publicly available information. I sat at my computer and typed out the first sentence. "The United States government assesses with high confidence that the Syrian government carried out a chemical weapons attack in the Damascus suburbs on August 21, 2013. For the next 2 days, I sat at my desk poring over the information and turning it into a short, stark, and simple analysis. I watched publicly available videos of people lying disoriented on the floors of hospitals, looked at pictures of dead children. I felt waves of anxiety, anticipating how I might be hauled before Congress if things went terribly wrong after a military intervention. I was responsible for writing the public document that would justify the United States going to war in Syria." Obama remained focused on the United Nations inspection team that was on the ground in Syria. That afternoon, he called Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, and urged him to pull them out. Ban refused, saying that the team had to finish their work. "I cannot overstate the importance of not remaining in Syria for a lengthy time," Obama said. Ban replied that it could take a few days. Obama pressed again, saying they should be out by the following night. To this day, I wonder if Obama would have launched a strike early that week if the UN team hadn't been in the way. Obama's next call was to Angela Merkel. There was no foreign leader he admired more. Like him, she was a pragmatist, driven by facts, dedicated to international order, deliberate in her decision-making. She had emerged as the dominant leader in Europe, working closely with Obama to respond to the global economic crisis and the instability in the Eurozone that followed. I'd seen them sit together, sometimes for hours, with notepads in front of them, designing strategies that could keep the global economy crawling forward, or hold Afghanistan together. Now, I sat in the Oval Office, listening to Obama ask for her support for military action. Even if Germany didn't participate, the United Kingdom and France had indicated that they would. But her public support would show that the United States and Europe were united, and could help bring along the rest of the European Union. Merkel argued that the UN team should have the time to prepare and submit its report, at which point we should pursue a Security Council resolution authorizing action. If the Russians blocked us, then at least we would have tried. This would take several weeks. Obama knew a delay of that length would tie his hands, especially because there wasn't much public support for war in the United States. As the fresh horror of Assad's attack faded, the opposition to a U.S. strike would build. With any additional time, Assad could also put innocent civilians around potential targets as human shields. I sat on the couch, watching him make this case, waiting for Merkel's words in response. I don't want you to get into a situation where you are left on a limb, she said. Obama listened intently as he cradled the phone against his ear while the rest of us listened on speaker. She said she wanted to use the time to build agreement among the European countries. Then, she said, we have a situation where you are not exposed to vague allegations. This is what I say as a friend. After he hung up the phone, he came over to where we were sitting. It was the first time I saw him look uneasy about acting in Syria. He asked our opinion on the timing for military action. I plunged into the case I'd been making in meetings, that only action by us would change the emerging dynamic, that the biggest concern in the United States and Europe was that we were going to have another Iraq war. Only by acting in a limited way, with airstrikes that were over after a period of days, could we demonstrate that we weren't beginning an all-out war. He listened, but I knew he was skeptical that we could contain military action once we'd begun. Just as things were stalling in Europe, congressional opposition to strikes was building at home. On Wednesday, a large group of Republican members of Congress wrote Obama a letter that threatened him bluntly. Engaging our military in Syria when no direct threat to the United States exists and without prior congressional authorization would violate the separation of powers that is clearly delineated in the Constitution. This was followed by a letter from the Speaker of the House, John Boehner. Even as the United States grapples with the alarming scale of the human suffering, it read, we are immediately confronted with contemplating the potential scenarios our response might trigger or accelerate. These considerations include the Assad regime potentially losing command and control of its stock of chemical weapons or terrorist organizations, especially those tied to Al-Qaeda, gaining greater control of and maintaining territory. He listed 14 detailed questions about various scenarios that could take place in Syria and demanded responses to each of those questions. Boehner also focused on the need for congressional authorization. It is essential you address on what basis any use of force would be legally justified and how the justification comports with the exclusive authority of congressional authorization under Article 1 of the Constitution. After deriding Obama's response to Syria as weak, Republicans were now making the same warnings about action that we had used to publicly defend our inaction in the past. In doing so, they were signaling that Obama would be held accountable if these scenarios were realized, while seeking impossible guarantees that they wouldn't be. More ominously, a message was being delivered. Acting without going to Congress would be unconstitutional. Our lawyers also had concerns. There was no firm international legal basis for bombing Syria, no argument of self-defense which justified our actions against Al-Qaeda, no UN resolution such as we had had in Libya. Nor was there any domestic legal basis beyond the assertion that the president had the inherent power to take military action that did not constitute a war under the Constitution, which the Republicans were disputing. Some argued that the Republicans could even try to impeach Obama if he acted without congressional authorization, hardly a wild thought, given their posture toward Obama. On Thursday afternoon, Dennis convened the National Security Team for a call with congressional leaders. One after the other, nearly all expressed some degree of support for strikes, but demanded that Obama seek authorization. Some were quoting a candidate questionnaire that Obama had filled out for the Boston Globe in 2007, in which he had said, "The president does not have power under the Constitution to unilaterally authorize a military attack in a situation that does not involve stopping an actual or imminent threat to the nation," an argument that had also been mounted against Obama after we intervened in Libya. I sat listening to all this, exhausted from staying up late the last two nights working on the assessment, getting angrier and angrier. It felt as if I was trapped within a system fueled by hypocrisy and opportunism. For 8 years, Republicans had defended Bush's ability to do whatever he pleased as commander-in-chief. Now they were suddenly devoted to constitutional limits on the commander-in-chief. I was used to the relentless style of politics from Obama's opponents, The effort to find any piece of information that could embarrass him, put him on the defensive, wound him politically. But I'd spent 2 days reading detailed descriptions of people being gassed to death, watching video of children with vacant eyes lying on the floor of a makeshift hospital. Faced with this harsh reality, Congress was focused on creating a political trap. During the meeting, we got word that the British Parliament had voted 285 to 272 against joining U.S.-led strikes on Syria after a debate filled with demands that the United Kingdom not follow the United States down the path to war, as Tony Blair had followed George W. Bush. A shell-shocked David Cameron called Obama to apologize, explaining that he could no longer offer his support. When I got back to my desk, I had distraught emails from Cameron's aides in which they worried about the damage to Britain's role in the world. The hangover from the Iraq War had left us staggering toward military intervention with next to no international support, and a Congress demanding that we go through the same divisive process of seeking authorization that had just failed in London. On Friday morning, I sat at my desk rereading the assessment, which I had reread more times than I could remember. I had checked every word with the Deputy Director of National Intelligence, Robert Cardillo, who stepped up to help us out, getting information declassified, editing the document, giving us maps to release, and offering to join the press briefing I would give when it was released. That morning, we released the United States government assessment of the Syrian government's use of chemical weapons on August 21, 2013. Shortly after, Kerry delivered his final case against Assad at the State Department. "My friends," he thundered, "it matters here if nothing is done. It matters if the world speaks out in condemnation and then nothing happens." We had a final National Security Council meeting that morning. Kerry suggested that we wait another week to bring other countries into a coalition. I argued that we had to act as soon as possible. Time was not our friend, and our military action was likely to change the public dynamic. Obama, who seemed increasingly focused on the factors aligning against us, pressed for the domestic and international legal basis that we could cite for taking action. In short, there was no good answer, other than to point back to when NATO had acted without an international mandate in Kosovo. Still, throughout the day, the drama of Kerry's speech and the horrific details in the public assessment seemed to tilt things back in the direction of action. It felt as if all of the week's setbacks and preemptive criticisms were part of an unfolding drama that would inevitably conclude in cruise missiles hitting Syria. Later that afternoon, I went to a meeting in Dennis's office where all the participants were slated to review their role in the event of a strike. We were discussing whether Obama had to address the nation in prime time as soon as the bombing began. Dennis, the sole voice against military action, got a note at the beginning of the meeting that Obama wanted to see him. He left and never returned. An hour later, I was back in the Situation Room when I got a note asking me to come to the Oval Office. I went upstairs and walked into Obama's office. He was alone and looked more relaxed than he had all week. Gone was the grave look that had been frozen on his face. He was looser, standing up from behind his desk and directing me to sit down on the couch. "I've got a big idea," he said. "Well," I replied, "you're the big idea guy." Sometimes, the more intense the moment, the more casual I would be with Obama in my comments. A handful of aides trickled in. Obama laid out his thinking. He had decided to seek congressional authorization for strikes on Syria. At some point, he said, a president alone couldn't keep the United States on a perpetual war footing, moving from one Middle Eastern conflict to the next. In the decade since 9/11, we'd gone to war in Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Somalia, and Libya. Now there was a demand that we go into Syria. Next, it would be Iran. "It is too easy for a president to go to war," he said. "That quote from me in 2007, I agree with that guy. That's who I am. And sometimes the least obvious thing to do is the right thing." If he attacked Syria without congressional authorization, the Republicans would come after him, and it would be impossible to sustain any military engagement in Syria. If we got congressional authorization for an attack on Syria, everyone would be in on the action, and we'd have more credibility, legally, politically, and internationally. If we couldn't, we shouldn't act. I sat slouched over on the couch across from him. I couldn't argue with anything he was saying, even though everything I'd been doing for the last few days, and everything I'd been arguing for the last 2 years, had been building up to a cruise missile strike on Syria the following day. It was as if Obama was finally forcing me to let go of a part of who I was, the person who looked at Syria and felt that we had to do something, who had spent 2 years searching for hope amid the chaos engulfing the Arab world and the political dysfunction at home. Obama had not put forward more than one option. It was clear that his mind was made up. Still, as always, he went around the room. One after the other, people voiced agreement with his direction. The only exception was Susan Rice. "We needed to hold Assad accountable," she said. "Congress is never going to give you this authority," she said, the only person to offer that prediction. "It gives away too much of your power as commander-in-chief." In the years to come, when nearly everyone involved in this drama decided to absolve themselves by saying that Obama should have bombed Assad without going to Congress, Susan never did. When it was my turn, I found myself almost speaking my thought process out loud. I told Obama I agreed with him. The downside of getting congressional authorization was, ironically, that we'd then have even more ownership over Syria. We'd be raising expectations around the world about what we were prepared to do and what we could achieve. But then I conceded that we had to, at some point, show that we meant what we said about not being on a permanent war footing. "We keep saying that," I said, "and I guess we have to show that we mean what we say." Speaking from my experience defending national security actions that we couldn't talk about, from drone strikes to supporting the Syrian opposition, I said I thought it was time to make decisions in the open. Then I gave voice to the building frustrations I'd been feeling, the sense of being trapped in systems that don't work. "In this Syria debate," I said, "we've seen a convergence of two dysfunctions in our foreign policy, Congress and the international community. They both press for action, but want to avoid any share of the responsibility." All week, I had been thinking the answer to that problem was to go ahead and do something. Now, I saw Obama's reasoning for why that wouldn't work. "At some point, we have to address that dysfunction head on." The meeting ended with Obama saying he would call each member of the National Security Cabinet that night and let them know his decision. The next morning, he would make a statement in the Rose Garden. The only caveat was the insistence by Susan and Obama's lawyers that we reserve the right to take action even if Congress didn't approve strikes, a point that made sense in terms of preserving flexibility, but which undercut the moral, ethical, and legal clarity of the stance Obama was taking. Obama called a couple of foreign leaders, including Netanyahu. "Your decision was right," he said, "and history will be kinder than public opinion." Over the next few days, we pivoted to seeking congressional support. In a meeting in the cabinet room between Obama and congressional leaders, Boehner pledged his support but said he would do nothing to help Obama get votes from within the Republican caucus. McConnell, who would end up criticizing Obama for not launching a strike, refused to offer his support. "Real profiles and courage," Obama said to us afterward. Foreign policy luminaries endorsed authorization. Clinton announced her support. AIPAC lobbied in support of our position. So did the Saudi government. But none of it mattered. No wave of support materialized in Congress or in public polls. One after another, members of Congress in both parties, including people who had demanded that we take action in Syria, announced that they would vote against authorizing it. On Thursday, we flew to Russia, where the G20 was being held at a lavish Tsarist palace on the outskirts of St. Petersburg. Putin recently returned to the presidency, had spared no expense in his preparations. Enormous gardens had been meticulously restored and guest houses set aside for each of the leaders. As we wandered the grounds, updates continued to pour in from Washington. A resolution authorizing the use of force had limped out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, but looked increasingly uncertain. The picture in the House was worse. Dennis was quarterbacking a frantic communications and legislative operation, despite a creeping sense of inevitable failure in Congress. Up to that point, I had generally avoided doing television interviews. The thought of them made me nervous, and I didn't want to enlarge the target on my back by diving into the cable news scrum. But Dennis was insisting that everyone get out there, so I trudged what seemed like more than a mile through 19th-century gardens, along a lake with a floating bar filled with drinking Russians and journalists, across a field, and up a staircase where an enormous black scaffold-like structure provided places for different international networks to hold interviews. I stood there in the slight chill of dusk, an earpiece playing questions in my ear, a microphone attached to my lapel, and dutifully answered questions, a disembodied head explaining why we needed to go into Syria. The next morning, I had to get up at 5 to catch a van back to the palace where the summit was taking place. I was dropped off at the villa where Obama was staying, which looked like a newly built and neatly appointed condominium that you might find alongside a golf course in Arizona. We still had a couple of hours until the meetings began, and I was told Obama was working out. I was rummaging through the fridge looking for a soda or something to eat, when Obama popped his head in and asked me to join him in the other room. He sat at a table wearing a gray t-shirt and black sweatpants. The television was playing the opening night game of the NFL season, a reminder of the time difference and just how far we were from home. The Broncos were running away with it. The game was on mute, and I started to update him on how support was slipping away, how even hawks on Syria, people like Marco Rubio, were tying themselves in knots to justify opposing authorization. "Maybe they just want to oppose you," I said. "Or maybe no one wants to be on the record in support of another war." I left unspoken the fact that the war could take a bad turn, like Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya. "Maybe we never would have done Rwanda," Obama said. The comment was jarring. Obama had written about how we should have intervened in Rwanda, and people like me had been deeply influenced by that inaction. But he also frequently pointed out that the people urging intervention in Syria had been silent when millions of people were killed in the Democratic Republic of Congo. "There's no way there would have been any appetite for that in Congress." "You could have done things short of war," I said.
"Like what?"
"Like jamming the radio signals they were using to incite people." He waved his hand at me dismissively.
"That's wishful thinking. You can't stop people from killing each other like that."
He let the thought hang in the air. "I'm just saying, maybe there's never a time when the American people are going to support this kind of thing. In Libya, everything went right. We saved thousands of lives. We didn't have a single casualty, and we took out a dictator who killed hundreds of Americans. And at home, it was a negative." His eyes shifted to the football game, a slow-motion replay of a Broncos player making a move. I saw what he had been doing, testing Congress, testing public opinion, to see what the real maneuvering room was for his office when it came to intervention in Syria. It was the same thing he'd done in Situation Room meetings on Syria, and in his mind, testing whether anything we did could make things better there, or whether it would turn out to be like Afghanistan and Iraq, if not worse. It wasn't just politics he was wrestling with. It was something more fundamental about America, our willingness to take on another war, a war whose primary justification would be humanitarian, a war likely to end badly. "People always say never again," he said. "But they never want to do anything." At that point, Susan Rice walked in, and the conversation shifted to the events of the day as a breakfast of bacon and eggs was served. Susan and I would spend all day trying to get a group of allies to issue a statement endorsing our position on Syria. It wasn't easy. The Germans preferred to wait for an upcoming European Union meeting.
The Saudis, who had spent so much time telling whoever would listen that Obama was weak on Syria, tried to avoid us. Obama finally had to intercept the leader of their delegation in a parking lot to lock in his support. "I wasn't going to let him leave," he told us later, "without looking me in the eye." On the flight home, Obama mentioned that he'd had a private conversation with Putin on the margins of the summit. For years, Obama had proposed that the United States and Russia work together to address the threat from Syria's chemical weapons stockpile. For years, Russia had resisted. This time, Obama again suggested working together to remove and destroy Syria's chemical weapons. Putin agreed and suggested that John Kerry follow up with his Russian counterpart. After we landed in Washington, Obama talked about the different ways in which the debate could play out. "The thing is," he said, "if we lose this vote, it will drive a stake through the heart of neoconservatism. Everyone will see they have no votes." I realized then that he was comfortable with either outcome. If we won authorization, he'd be in a strong position to act in Syria. If we didn't, then we would potentially end the cycle of American wars of regime change in the Middle East. Kerry worked quickly to turn Putin's overture into an agreement that could be implemented in a country, Syria, that had never even acknowledged having chemical weapons. 4 days after we got back to Washington, the Syrian government announced they would give them up. 5 days later, on September 10th, Obama addressed the nation and announced that we would pursue this diplomatic opportunity. The congressional vote never took place. Thousands of tons of chemical weapons would be removed from Syria and destroyed, far more than could have been destroyed through military action. The war would continue. Barack Obama would continue to keep the United States out of it. Chapter 19. Becoming a Right-Wing Villain. The more comfortable I became working in the White House, the more uncomfortable I became with the way the world looked at me from outside of it. Over time, the White House complex becomes familiar, just the place where you happen to work. The recognition of the building appearing in the distance, the tourists taking selfies in front of the gate, the bomb-sniffing dogs that greet your car when you drive in, it all becomes the backdrop to your life. The setting where you attend daily meetings and have hallway conversations about sports and television shows. A bust of Abraham Lincoln sits outside the men's restroom. A panel of drawings by Norman Rockwell in the West Wing lobby depicts what it was like to wait in that very spot to see Franklin Roosevelt. You find the smoking area next to the place where a wall is still discolored from when the British tried to burn the place down during the War of 1812. But it can also be a dangerous place to work. During my first year in the job, I was hanging out in my friend Alyssa Mastromonaco's office when Pete Rouse walked in, a senior advisor to Obama who had been such an institution on Capitol Hill that he was referred to as the 101st Senator. He asked us if we had federal liability insurance. I didn't even know what that was or why I'd need it. "Look it up," he said. "This is not optional." I did what I was told and ended up spending a couple hundred dollars a year to cover legal expenses that might come from investigations. This ended up saving me around $100,000. My initiation into the ritual of being investigated began in the spring of 2012 when two national security leaks to the press took place within a matter of days. David Sanger of the New York Times published a book that included details about an alleged cyber weapon that had sabotaged parts of the Iranian nuclear program, and the Associated Press reported that the United States had a source inside the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen who helped thwart a terrorist attack. Leaks aren't all that unusual. These two were different because they were detailed and took place in the spring of a presidential election year. Republicans demanded investigations. They're intentionally leaking information to enhance President Obama's image as a tough guy for the election, John McCain declared. That is unconscionable. Attorney General Eric Holder assigned U.S. attorneys to investigate. Anyone who works in national security communications hates leaks because, inevitably, You have to respond to information that you aren't allowed to discuss publicly. Given that part of my job involved talking to the press about national security, I was on the list of people who would be ensnared in both investigations –